Chancellor Merkel all said, we don't want to bring Russia back into the G7. This open defiance and disagreement with the United States is really unprecedented.
Hi, everyone. I'm Dana Lewis in London, and welcome to Backstory. While you were rightly concerned about police violence in America and trying to cope with a pandemic, don't feel bad if you didn't notice this curveball President Trump just threw NATO and specifically Germany. The White House is not so quietly leaking a decision to pull a third of America's 35,000 soldiers out of Germany. And it appears Trump is doing it because, well, he's never gotten along well with German Chancellor Angela Merkel. And she just said she wouldn't attend a G7 meeting in June, especially since Trump wanted to invite Russian President Putin. But Trump has never gotten along with Merkel. Just listen to a small portion of his rant about Germany buying its energy supplies from Russia.
But Germany is totally controlled by Russia because they were getting from 60 to 70% of their energy from Russia and a new pipeline. And you tell me if that's appropriate, because I think it's not. And I think it's a very bad thing for NATO.
And Angela Merkel, who's clearly frosty towards Trump, took a veiled swipe at him during a speech last year at Harvard.
Tear down walls of ignorance and narrow-mindedness, for nothing has to stay as it is.
But reducing America's force in Europe and NATO has serious consequences, and it sends the wrong message to an aggressive Russia. And to explain all this, you can't hear more eloquent, wiser words from Ambassador Nicholas Burns and our second guest, the former commander of U.S. military in Europe, former Lieutenant General Ben Hodges. First, Nicholas Burns. All right, Ambassador Nicholas Burns was in the Foreign Service for 27 years. He was the U.S. ambassador to NATO, and he is currently professor of diplomacy and international politics at Harvard's John F. Kennedy School of Government. Thank you for joining us, Mr. Ambassador.
Dana, it's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you so much.
Ambassador, President Trump apparently wants to pull about one-third of American troops out of Germany. Good idea?
Terrible idea. Not
Why?
In the interest of the United States. The American troops are in Germany, obviously to help protect Germany and other European countries, but mainly because it's in the interest of the United States in two respects. It's a way that the United States can, within NATO, contain Putin and contain Russian aggression in Eastern Europe. It's also been the jumping off point for the United States into North Africa. As we say, we help the French try to contain the terrorist threat in places like Mali and Niger. And it was a jumping off point for our major wars that we fought in Iraq and Afghanistan because of the extraordinary infrastructure that we have built up with Germany over the last several decades. Ramstein Air Base, for instance, being the major air base the United States uses. So this is penny wine, pound foolish. It's also part, in my view, of the strategic incoherence of what President Trump is trying to do with Europe. He's been very weak on Europe.
Is this more about his personality than strategy? Because he was angry at Angela Merkel for not wanting to attend the G7. I mean, is this personality or is this him going back to NATO contributions and all of that?
It's not strategic. It appears to be spite. He has had it out for Angela Merkel from the beginning of his presidency. I think he's been more critical of her publicly and privately than just about any world leader. He never breathed a word of disrespect or disagreement with Xi Jinping or Putin or Kim Jong-un, but he's been a consistent critic of hers, and he was apparently furious that she decided not to attend his planned G7 meeting in Washington at a time when it's difficult for leaders to travel because of the coronavirus. We still have high infection rates here in the United States, and I think for a president of the United States to pull 9,500 American troops out of Germany because he's upset with the German chancellor is not strategic. It's foolish.
So will Congress allow him to do it?
It's going to be interesting to see. I mean, there is, I think, a movement in Congress right now to assert itself, perhaps to pass a resolution against this decision or to try to delay it. Congress does hold the purse strings. One of the other reasons why we've expanded the American troop presence in Germany just over the last 5 years was after Putin's annexation of Crimea and his placement of Russian troops inside Ukraine in 2014 and 15, the Obama administration and the Trump administration have effectively rebuilt the U.S. armored presence in Europe that had been hollowed out to fight the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's part of a strategic effort to make deterrence stronger against Putin as he threatens the Baltic states and Poland, and as he, of course, has acted illegally in both Georgia and Ukraine. So it's a very important strategic move. Congress and both parties had funded a fairly substantial buildup, multi-billion dollar buildup of American armored presence, and now the president's going to counteract that. He appears not to have had any major discussions inside the administration with the State and Defense Departments. And of course, the fact, given Donald Trump's record, he didn't let the Germans know ahead of this announcement. This is
He wants to bring Russia back into the G7 he talked about.
He does.
Doing that. Is that in America's interest right now?
No. I was part of the effort to bring Russia, to expand the G7 to the G8 to include Russia back in the 1990s when I was special assistant to President Clinton for Russia and Ukraine affairs. But that was the 1990s when President Yeltsin was in power. We were partners with Russia. Putin is an adversary of the entire NATO alliance. He has annexed Crimea, which is a flagrant violation of international law. That's why sanctions were placed by the EU, Canada, and the United States on Putin. And the idea you'd invite him back to the G7 is anathema to all the other G7 leaders. You saw this extraordinary week last week when Prime Minister Trudeau, Prime Minister Boris Johnson, Chancellor Merkel all said, we don't want to bring Russia back into the G7. This open defiance and disagreement with the United States is really unprecedented in my 40 years of participation and observation of these events.
Dangerous times we live in. I mean, we are seeing a number of treaties that President Trump has walked away from, open skies. And now START, as you know, is supposed to be renewed next year. And it looks like President Trump is saying we're not going to renew START. And the Russians are encouraging America to do so. I spoke the other day to Rose Gottemueller, who was the main chief negotiator for the U.S. And she talked about how, yes, you could bring China in later on, but in the meantime, you need to extend that treaty and not let it expire. We are entering into a new arms race. Does it worry you when you start adding up all of these treaties we're walking away from and where that leads us in terms of the dangers to a nuclear exchange possibly with Russia and others?
Well, I think it's the most dangerous time in terms of nuclear weapons proliferation and instability in the last half century since President Kennedy and President Johnson began arms control with the Soviet Union back in the depths of the Cold War. I would not blame it, obviously, all on President Trump. I think the Russians are largely to blame. They're the ones who violated the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty that subsided, as you know, more than a year ago. And all of NATO was opposed to that. The Russians have introduced supersonic missiles and other strategic both strategic and intermediate range accords. And so I think the Russians are at the heart of this problem, but I agree that open skies for the United States to leave that was very much in our interest. START renewal, February 1, 2021. It's a difficult issue because I think there's an argument to be made that we should seriously consider extending it to provide for stability in strategic nuclear arms. But I do think the Trump administration has a point that China is absent from all of these arms agreements. China's now, without any question, a greater military power than Russia, all told. And I think the United States, and I hope Russia, as well as the NATO allies, will pressure China to agree to limits on its nuclear program. And so the Trump strategy here is not irrational. They're trying to convince the Chinese, leverage the Chinese, that they have to make, they have to be part of the arms control regime itself.
Can I just talk to you very briefly about what's happening in America?
Yes, please.
It is troubling everywhere. And how does this allow the U.S. to preach to others now about human rights and democracy? I mean, largely, I've spent my career, and I know you spent your career, watching other nations and talking to other nations about the way government should work and democracy should work, and America's been that great leader in that. And suddenly now, the shine is off, isn't it? And it's compromising it's troubling for the rest of the world. And where does it leave America in terms of its diplomacy?
Well, we live in a glass house. Race has been a curse on our history. We've never gotten it right. We've never done right by the African-American community, going all the way back to 1619, Dana, when the first slave ship arrived in Virginia. And it's been the seminal event and issue in our history. And I think millions of Americans, and you can see this in those demonstrating and speaking out, feel heartbroken over the murder of George Floyd, the systemic racism, the police mistreatment of young African-American men. There's so many examples of it, and the racism that exists in our society. And until we get a grip on this, until we truly make progress, it's going to be difficult for the United States to be totally credible on the issue of human rights when we lecture the Chinese, as we should, frankly, on their deficiencies in Hong Kong, on their attitudes towards Taiwan, on their abhorrent treatment of the Uyghur population of Xinjiang province. The Chinese come right back at us with this charge, well, look at your own house. And so I think we're at a point in American history where our greatest weakness globally are the dysfunctions in Washington, the political dysfunctions, the racism in our country, the red-blue divide. We're at a time we need to heal America so that, in part, America can be more effective and honest in our global policy.
Are you confident that you're in a healing process, or are you just entering something more dangerous than that?
It's interesting. I'm confident that I've never seen the American public more engaged on race than it is right now. African Americans have always been engaged. They have to be engaged. They're the victims. White Americans are taking to the streets and speaking out in a way that I never thought was possible. And I'm old enough to have been 12 in 1968, during the most terrible year in our modern history, with the assassinations of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy and the Vietnam War and the violence in our streets. And I think if there is a silver lining in this very dark cloud, it is that people are really standing up here and holding the government to account. And the opposition to what President Trump tried to do, which was to bring the military into the streets to deny the First Amendment rights of peaceful protesters, fundamental to the entire history of the country and the idea of America, it's inspiring to see four former chairs of the Joint Chiefs of Staff all speak out against what President Trump tried to do. People are standing up. We've just got to keep it going. And I'm going to be very, in a sense, partisan by saying we have to defeat Donald Trump on November 3rd. I'm an advisor to Joe Biden. I've been supporting him for 14 months. And I think leadership is the key here in the White House, in governor's mansions, in city halls, in our communities. We need to take back the America that we love and that is so important, I think, to the rest of the world, too, that democratic, human rights-oriented America. And that's the one you're talking about, Dana. And I think this crisis is the most profound crisis we've faced, the racial crisis.
Ambassador Burns, thank you so much for your wise thoughts. And it's always an honor to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Dana, thank you. Honor to be on your program. Thanks so much.
All right, joining me now, Ben Hodges, a lieutenant general, is a retired United States Army officer who served as commanding general, United States Army Europe, and he is currently the Pershing Chair in Strategic Studies at the Center for European Policy Analysis, and he's talking to us from Frankfurt, Germany. So that's important, I think, because he understands exactly both sides of the pond on these issues with NATO and troops in Europe. Ben, if I can start off, I mean, President Trump, as you're well aware, has reportedly ordered the U.S. military to remove 9,500 troops from Germany. The move could reduce the U.S. contingent to 25,000. Can I get your reaction on it?
Well, Dana, first of all, thanks for the opportunity. Even people in the Pentagon and at NATO and other headquarters are referring all questions to the White House, which tells me that, you know, this is not tied to any sort of a strategic analysis. This is a purely political calculation. If it's true, then I think it's a colossal mistake because of the damage it does to the cohesion of the alliance, as well as a significant reduction to actual capability that's here in Europe.
When you're saying it's political, not strategic, I mean, that plays into the idea that President Trump got angry with the German Chancellor Angela Merkel and said, fine, you're not coming to the G7. We're going to take some troops out of Germany and penalize you. I mean, can you imagine an American president making a decision on something so strategic as military interests in Europe on the basis that he's just angry about a conference, a G7 conference?
The timing of this leaves it open to question. I mean, the fact that you've asked that, and I've seen that from others as well, is a reflection of the damaged relationship between the United States and Germany. The fact that somebody, you know, professional journalists and others would automatically connect Chancellor Merkel saying she's not coming to the G7 to a response by the American president like that. I believe that this is something that the former ambassador, Richard Grenell, has been encouraging for several months. I don't know what caused the president to, if he said this, I don't know what caused it to happen right now, but certainly the timing is not helpful with regards to the relationship. Now, to her credit, Chancellor Merkel, of course, you know, has had pretty tough measures in place here in Germany as far as closing down businesses, stopping gatherings. And so for her to then appear in Washington in a closed group kind of setting, you could see that's a difficult position for her, like it would be for any other political leader that has imposed restrictive measures. So I think it was almost impossible for her to accept the invitation.
You're saying that the ambassador Grenell, the former ambassador, was pushing this to draw down American troops in Germany. Why?
I think the ambassador has from day one, actually even before he arrived to take office as our ambassador in Germany, he was already advocating for Germany needing to do a lot more as part of its role inside the alliance. And for sure, every president has said that our European allies needed to do more. But there was a particular edge to the ambassador's approach that I actually always felt was counterproductive. And so over the last few months, he has advocated for this, but it reflected, in my view, a misunderstanding or a lack of appreciation for why we have troops in Germany. They're not here to protect Germans. They're forward stationed, just like U.S. Air Force that's based in the U.K. It's not there to protect the U.K. It's forward stationed for our interests.
How in our interests? I mean, how does that serve our interests?
So, well, number one, our interests are best protected by a strong, cohesive alliance. NATO, not perfect, but still the most successful alliance in the history of the world. And so our contribution to NATO, whether it's air forces, land forces, Navy, intelligence, missile defense, that's our contribution to the collective defense effort of NATO. So you've got 30 nations committed to each other. That protects America's interests. Secondly, in a more practical way, having bases like Ramstein, for example, in Germany, allows us to project power or to support operations and support presence in Africa and the Middle East. The hospital at Landstuhl, another example of soldiers who were wounded in Afghanistan and Iraq, were flown back into Landstuhl. No telling how many young men and women's lives were saved by having a very large, capable medical center here in Germany. The number of troops that are in Germany, about 34,000 Army and Air Force. I mean, that would not fill up half of a major football stadium in America. So we're talking about actually a very small number of people, but they give us infrastructure, a footprint that allows us to project power as well as demonstrate commitment to the rest of the allies.
When you were the commanding general of U.S. Army in Europe, obviously, part of what your the drills you're running, the strategy you're looking at constantly is a threat from Russia. And I know that you were probably quite involved in dealing with Ukraine as well, and the Russian incursion into Ukraine and the seizure of Crimea. And how important are those troops in Germany and our presence in Germany and our contribution to NATO in terms of holding the line, if you want to call it that, in Eastern Europe against President Putin?
So the deterrence is all about having capability and demonstrating the capability and demonstrating the will to use the capability. That's the whole theory of deterrence. And so if you don't have actual capability there, then obviously you don't have deterrence. Or if you don't demonstrate that you have that capability, you don't have effective deterrence. Unlike in the Cold War, when I was a lieutenant a very long time ago, and we had almost 300,000 troops, you know, the expectation was that, or the threat.
300,000 troops, and now you're down to 34,000.
Yeah. So basically, when I was a lieutenant, you know, we had 300,000. The mission was to deter the Soviet Union, protect American interests, and assure America's allies. Today, we have about 30,000 troops, and the mission is to deter Russia, protect America's interests, and assure America's allies. So that presence is an important part of that. But unlike during the Cold War, when the Soviet Union clearly had intentions to conquer, to invade West Germany, we know that from the end of the Cold War, studying the plans and so on. Now, Russia, the Kremlin, does not have the capability to do that, but they also don't have the desire to do that. What they want to do is anything they can to undermine the cohesion of the alliance. So they use cyber, they use disinformation, and frequently they'll talk about the use of nuclear weapons. So to put in the mind of all political leaders that if they launched a short, quick attack into, say, Lithuania or Romania or Estonia, and then they stop and they say, do you really want to get into a nuclear war over Lithuania? And of course, if the alliance doesn't respond to that, then they have effectively wrecked NATO and undermined our alliance. And they also use what their support for the Assad regime in Syria and Libya, which is only made possible because we have not competed effectively in the Black Sea, from their bases in Ukraine. That has put more than 3 million refugees on the road out of Syria into Turkey and the rest of Europe, which obviously undermines the European Union. There's support for General Haftar in Libya. Potentially, there's another million refugees coming across the Mediterranean into Europe. This is not accidental. This is weaponization of refugees by the Kremlin. So competing in the Ukraine, not in the Ukraine, competing in Ukraine is important because without Crimea, without Russia's illegal annexation of Crimea and this bridge they built across the Kerch Strait, which chokes Ukrainian ports on Sea of Azov, this gives Russia the opportunity to dominate in the Black Sea and use it as their launching pad for all the malign activity they're conducting in the Middle East.
So how do you analyze the wisdom then of President Trump flirting with the idea of normalizing relations with Russia and maybe even suggesting he could have gone to that G7 meeting with Angela Merkel?
Well, even the European allies that tend to be more open to engagement with the Kremlin were astounded that the president would offer an invitation to President Putin to come to the G7. I mean, then they all said that this was completely unacceptable. And an invitation like that, just like a proposal to reduce by almost a third American troops in Germany, is a gift to the Kremlin. They've done nothing to merit such a reduction or an invitation. If anything, they've continued to kill Ukrainian troops in the Donbass every week. They've continued their disinformation efforts, their cyber attacks, and their illegal claims to territorial waters and exclusive economic zone around the Crimea. Why in the world would we offer them? I mean, that's the opposite of being a great negotiator.
It's interesting in terms of timing that Russia, because you mentioned the nuclear threat and, you know, a scenario where they might try to seize Estonia or Latvia or Lithuania. Russia has just come out and published its doctrine. Not accidentally, they've made it quite known that they might see a limited nuclear exchange or use of a nuclear device in relation to a conflict with NATO. Trump has said he won't renew the START nuclear treaty. He's abandoned the open skies. He's walked away from the INF, the Intermediate Range Treaty. These treaties, I mean, a lot of critics will say steered us away from a nuclear war, limited or otherwise, because a lot of people don't think you can have a limited exchange anyway, that they have steered us away from a nuclear conflict with Russia. And now we are in a new arms race with super duper missiles and, to quote President Trump, and other things. Are you worried about the direction that we're heading in, and very rapidly so?
So I'm worried on a couple of levels. First, when it comes to these treaties, all of them have flaws because they're all the result of compromise and negotiation. So they, all of them will have some flaw. But as you state, the arms control protocols and efforts over the past decades have kept us. Even though both sides had thousands of nuclear weapons, we've managed to reduce the risk as well as the numbers. I mean, something like 80% reduction in nuclear weapons overall, 90% reduction of nuclear weapons that were based in Europe. This is not inconsequential. I would much rather that we stay inside treaties as well as international and multilateral organizations and fix them versus walking away from them. I would prefer that the United States lead, not leave. Now, our allies could behave much better. Germany, France, the UK, others, for example, in INF, they knew for years that Russia was in violation of INF. They've known for years that Russia was in violation of Open Skies Treaty. Those countries, instead of criticizing the United States for walking away from them, should have been putting big pressure on the Kremlin to live up to it. And the United States, if we were had been thinking more strategically, should have been working with Germany in particular to put pressure on the Kremlin. I think Germany is the only country that can actually influence Kremlin behavior because of its economic power and its leadership inside the European Union. And the same, by the way, with the Chinese Communist Party. So a better approach, in my view, and it's very difficult, obviously, but to work closely with those allies that can bring to bear the right kind of economic leverage on the Kremlin and on the Chinese Communist Party.
Now, how do you, sorry?
I was just going to say, it's I'm not opposed to the administration's desire to get China involved in the arms control process. And of course, the Chinese Communist Party right now has zero incentive and zero desire to be a part of it. So there is a strategic challenge for the United States that we can't keep our hands tied here while the Chinese develop unlimited capabilities. That is a concern. And for sure,
Well, you don't necessarily have to make a choice, do you? I mean, you could extend START with Russia and then pursue negotiations with China. And that was always, if you can comment on that, but that was always the idea, was when you're having 30, 40,000 nuclear weapons on either side of the Soviet Union and America, you can't start talking to people who have nuclear weapons that number in a few hundred. So what you need to do is get the base down to 1,500, as President Obama's negotiations did on START 2. And then work from there towards 1,000, and then bring in the other nuclear powers and try to get them then to sign on to these declarations as well. But you don't have to abandon one to pursue the others, do you?
No, absolutely not. I agree with you. I'm just saying that that's the challenge, is trying to figure out how do you put pressure on the Chinese while still maintaining or continuing a process, and you, without Germany and other countries bringing pressure, I don't think we're going to be successful.
Ben, I've known you since you were a brigade commander for some 20 years now. I think we're getting close to 20 years anyway. And I know the military well because I've been embedded a number of times, and I would not normally ask you a political question because I know you wouldn't answer. When you look at what's going on in America right now, your colleagues, never before have they stepped up and stepped out and spoken out against the use of military by the administration. James Mattis to Colin Powell to dozens of commanders now have come out and said that Trump should not deploy the military in the United States. I'd like your comment on that. Why does it go against what you believe in? I assume it does.
Yeah, of course. You know, I... I keep a copy of the Constitution. I've had this for decades, actually, because we take an oath to the Constitution all the time. Every time there's a reenlistment or a promotion, or it's something that is so ingrained in our fiber from the time you go through your officer training throughout your entire career. So that's why you see a real anxiety by officers, including retired officers, about what we see. The respect for civilian authority is so ingrained. The respect for our fellow citizens and not using force against fellow citizens is so anathema to everybody in the military, and particularly when we understand the difference between National Guard and regular Army, that there's a reason for that when we grow up in that. So you can see professional officers of all the services really wrestled with this idea. Just like we also hate seeing, you know, monuments in Washington, D.C. being defaced and violence. So there's it was a struggle. I think that when I think about in 1957, when President Eisenhower deployed soldiers from the 327th Infantry Regiment of the 101st. Now, the reason I'm so familiar with this is because the 327th Infantry, of course, is the core of 1st Brigade of the 101st. That's my regiment. And we have a memorial in the brigade headquarters there to when our soldiers were sent to Little Rock, Arkansas, to protect 9 young black children trying to go into a high school that the governor of Arkansas had used the Arkansas National Guard to prevent from happening. And so President Eisenhower, in order to protect these 9 young kids, but also because the image of the United States was so terrible as race riots were happening, the president felt it was appropriate to use the military at that time. And I would completely agree. I've seen nothing in this situation that would warrant the use of the regular military in any kind of a federal role. I think there's so much more that could be done. And you know, part of the negative reaction is also because of the language. I mean, when the Secretary of Defense talks about dominating battle space, when we're talking about American cities,
incredible.
I mean, it's aberrant to everybody. And so I certainly would agree with the criticisms of General Mattis, Admiral Mullen, and others.
What would you have advised the president if you had been with him and he had said, clear Lafayette Park, I want to go for a walk, and we're going to use tear gas and rubber bullets to do that?
Well, first of all, I am very sure that Mark Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, pushed very hard against the president on using the Insurrection Act and bringing in the regular Army. There's no doubt in my mind that he fought back against that very hard. Of course, I was not in the room when the decision, when the president says, hey, let's go walk over to the church. I believe Mark Milley when he says, we thought we were going to visit the guardsmen that were out there, which makes perfect sense. I mean, that's what a commander does. Of course, he's a chairman, he's not the commander, but that's what a leader does. You go see for yourself the conditions. And especially if the president's turning to you to give advice about using military, it would seem completely appropriate to go see for yourself what's going on out there. What the unfortunate part is, this turned into this photo op that was not impromptu by the president, but I think it was a total surprise to Chairman Milley. And, you know, obviously he exited the scene immediately. I think in hindsight, they should have been more savvy to what might happen here. And they probably.
But it was wrong.
Yeah.
You're saying it was wrong.
Yeah. In hindsight, I think he probably wishes that they should have been more attuned to what this president would do. And I guess that this is the point, that the president will use the military, and he's talked about it so much, and the language coming out of the White House is just not appropriate. And so I think every officer, and you've seen it probably, you know, every one of the services has reminded everybody about our constitutional responsibilities, legal orders. And there's no doubt in my mind that Mark Milley, I've known him for a very long time, that there have been some serious heated debates and pushback by him on the civilian leadership. And I have great confidence in him and his judgment.
I'll just pursue it with one last question and then let you and wrap this up. But philosophically, are you not on a short string to the White House and the president? Or philosophically, what is the command chain there in terms of responsibility to the U.S. military and commanders like yourself?
Well, of course, I am retired. So
never retired, Ben. It's in your blood. You're never retired. But indeed, you are retired, sir. Yeah.
So, well, in the Constitution, Article 1 lays out the responsibilities of the Congress. Article 2 lays out the responsibilities of the president. That's not an administrative accident. Article 1, so priority is to the legislative branch of government. Article 2 is where it says the president is commander in chief, but the military has a responsibility to the Congress also, and that's why our oath is to support and defend the Constitution of the United States. Now, you know, in that excellent article by Ann Applebaum where she talks about how do people, how do really good people become complicit with behavior, and you know, there's rationalization and maybe I can still kind of control it or influence it, or, you know, there's different ways that people try to deal with that. For me, there's no doubt in my mind, I would have no problem telling Mr. President, I'm obviously not your guy, because there's no way I'm going to do that. Now, it's easier for me to say that here in the safety of my retirement, but I am very confident that 3 years ago, if I had been asked when I was commander of U.S. Army Europe to do something that I knew was going to undermine our constitutional authority and also the credibility of the Army as a protector of the people, that the American. In fact, I've always bragged to my friends that, hey, you can be sure the American people never worry that the guys with all the guns, the military, are going to take matters into their own hands in the United States. And so that's part of the culture. And I no doubt I would have lived up to that, whatever the consequences would have been.
Ben Hodges, a great pleasure to talk to you, sir. You're the Pershing Chair of Strategic Studies at the Center of European Policy Analysis, also fluent in Germany, and you're based in Frankfurt. It's a great gift to be able to get your views on all this.
And thanks very much for what you're doing, and thanks for the opportunity.
And that's another edition of Backstory. Please, wherever you listen to Backstory, subscribe and share. I'm Dana Lewis. Talk to you soon.